Our annual summer series, Underappreciated, explores works of literature by authors who are either unknown or have been forgotten by American readers. This year's first segment looks at Hans Falada, a German writer who enjoyed great popularity before World War II, but has fallen into relative obscurity in the years since. His final novel, Every Man Dies Alone, concerns a working-class German couple who decide to take a stand against the Nazis. Joining me now to speak about Hans Falada and his work is Dennis Johnson, publisher at Melville House, the publisher of four new published editions. Hans Falada considered a major author in the 1920s?
1930s. He was pretty big here and in the UK. He was a best-selling author. He was a Book of the Month Club selection. He had all the big hits you're supposed to have in your bestseller. In fact, his first book translated into English, a book called Little Man, What Now?, was turned into a very successful Hollywood movie. But of course, as luck would have it for unlucky Hans Falada, that just led to trouble at home when the rising Nazi party discovered that the film had been produced by Jews.
Although it didn't have an anti-Nazi theme.
No, it's actually a very, it's a surprisingly dark movie for its day. It's just pre-Hays Code, and it does have scenes where they're wandering through Berlin and going through the park, and there are Nazis giving speeches to the crowd and on soapbox, and it certainly depicts the moment when they were starting to come into power.
Is he still read in Germany?
He is. He's never been out of print in Germany. He's a little better known in East Germany, where he was regularly taught in schools, because that's where he ended up after the war, but he didn't live too long after the war.
You've published four of his novels, Every Man Dies Alone, this with the new translation. Are the others Little Man, What Now?, The Drinker, Wolf Among Wolves, older translations?
One of them, the drinker wasn't even kind of decoded until 5 years after Falada's death. He wrote it while he was in a Nazi insane asylum, and he had to kind of write it surreptitiously, not exactly in a code, but he kept a manuscript where he would write between the lines and crossways and every way so that you just couldn't read what he was writing. And it took a long time to decipher that after his death. And that was first translated in 1950. Little Man is a translation from the 80s that we purchased. And then Wolf Among Wolves, the most recent release in the series, is actually an unexpurgated transition, a translation. We took the original translation and put a lot of stuff, retranslated stuff that hadn't been included in that and stuck it in. So it's kind of an old and new translation simultaneously.
It had been expurgated for American readers or English language readers?
I think it had been expurgated for a couple of reasons. One is it's really long. It's our edition is over 800 pages. The original American edition was 6-something. And there were some political things taken out. There was also, I think, some stylistic choices were made. There was a lot of very kind of Germanic of the earth writing, praises to Mother Nature, that I think somewhere along the line, a Simon & Schuster editor just decided that's not very American.
Now, the encrypted novel, The Drinker, that was written under orders from Goebbels, wasn't it? Except that he didn't do what he was ordered to do?
Well, one way that Falada dealt with the Nazis, he had some problems. Goebbels loved him. Goebbels thought he was a terrific writer and loved him and would always call him in and say, you know, that last book was terrific, except you should have made the Jew the villain at the end of it. So why don't you think about rewriting that? And he would keep pressure on Falada like that. And Falada was very heroic in his resistance, but at one point he was called in, and there was a banking scandal in Berlin in the 20s that he was interested in. There were a couple of Jewish bankers involved, so he would always tell the propaganda minister's office, this is my next book. I'm going to write about these Jews that committed this banking fraud on our nation. And he would never get to the novel. So when he was incarcerated in the insane asylum, which was basically a death warrant in Nazi Germany, he told his keepers there, you know, I'm supposed to be writing this book for Herr Goebbels. You need to give me some paper so that I can get going on it. And he just wrote away. and kept writing very happily and outlasted the regime.
And what is that book about?
That book is The Drink. Well, there are three books. One is The Drinker. One was a children's book that he wrote. He wrote a lot of children's books. And another one was a memoir about his life under the Nazis. The Drinker, the novel that we published, was a novel about a man who was so oppressed by his society that he just kind of willfully decides to become an alcoholic and drink himself to death. It was a very autobiographical novel. It's probably the darkest book Falada ever wrote. It's the first book of his that I wrote and that I read, and I was just utterly floored by it and couldn't believe that I hadn't heard of this writer before after reading that book.
My guest is Dennis Johnson, publisher of Melville Books and the publisher of four novels by Hans Falada. You've called the lack of attention he's received a literary injustice, but then you admit that you'd not heard of Falada until fairly recently.
Well, that's the nice thing about having your own publishing company. You can make up for your own mistakes.
How did you even discover him?
Well, he was recommended to me. I believe that a great deal of really important, fascinating, wonderful literature was lost between the wars in that part of the world, in the Baltic states. And so whenever I meet anybody with a particular knowledge or experience of that part of the world, I ask for recommendations. And I happened to do a book with the fashion designer Diane von Furstenberg. And her family had come through that part of the world at that time, and she told me that her favorite writer was a guy named Hans Falada, and I didn't know about him, so she filled me in a little, and it took me a while to track down his books, but when I finally got a hold, because he was out of print here, but when I finally got hold of The Drinker, I was on my way.
And you have blurbs from Alan First, somebody who knows a bit about the pre-war Europe. He's also a fan?
He's become a real champion of the book, of Hans Falada. We approached him just to see if we could get a blurb. I know his books are so meticulously researched, I felt he would know about Falada, but he didn't know about him either. And he very similarly became totally enchanted with him and has gone on to write essays about him and to talk about him in interviews completely unprompted by Melville House. So it was a very nice way to get to know him.
During his heyday, did Falada influence other writers?
Not really. He was a very standalone kind of guy. He wanted to keep out of trouble. He always seemed to get in trouble, and he worked very hard to keep out of it. So
he had a wild life.
Well, he did. There needs to be a great biography of him. There's only one in English so far, and it doesn't really do him justice. But he had any number of amazing traumas that would be the stuff of a single life, of a single novel. But he had numerous. When he was a young man, for example, he was involved in a duel. There was a wave of suicide sweeping Germany and teenagers, and he and a friend decided that they too were going to commit suicide, and to preserve the honor of their parents, they would mask it as a duel. And unfortunately, Falada's friend missed Falada, but Falada did not miss him, and he killed him. And he was so distraught that he picked up his friend's gun and shot himself. He survived. But that led to a year-long time in the hospital, the introduction to painkillers that would become a lifelong addiction.
He was also injured by a horse-drawn cart.
As an even younger man, he was run over by a horse and carriage, kicked in the head, hospitalized for a year. He had typhoid as a teenager. He had a very traumatic childhood, and he was also the son of a very important figure in that time in Germany. His father was the equivalent of a German Supreme Court justice. So there was a lot of pressure on him to be a model citizen, and he just could not bear up.
He was born Rudolf Ditson today. In fact, today's would be his 117th birthday,
I
guess.
That's exactly right, which I didn't even realize myself until last night. I don't think your producer knew. It's an amazing coincidence.
Why did he write under the name Hans Falada?
Because he did not want to embarrass his father, the Supreme Court justice. And he drew the name from a couple of different Grimm's fairy tales. Falada was a talking donkey who was very prescient, and the other character was actually in a fairy tale, I believe, called Unlucky Hans. So he thought this was a good name.
When his British publisher sent a boat to take him and his family out of Germany, he refused to get on. Wouldn't he have been free to write whatever he wanted, the way Thomas Mann was and some other German writers?
Well, this is the thing that utterly sold me on Hans Falada as a hero. It's a very moving story. And when I read that story in Jenny Williams' biography, I told my wife, we've just got to track this guy down and revive his career. And the story was that, yes, indeed, writers were fleeing the Reich in the mid-30s. Hesse, Brecht, Thomas Mann, you name it, they fled. And Falada's publisher, George Putnam, actually an American, but it was his British brand that published him, sent a boat to get him out. And they packed up the car, they got the kids, they stuffed the car, and Falada had removed himself to the country outside Berlin, to a beautiful small little farm. And he told his wife to stay with the kids in the car. He was going to take a last walk around the property because he felt he might never see his country again. And then when he came back from that walk, he said, get the kids out of the car, unpack the bags, we're not going anywhere. And I was extremely, I'm moved just recounting the story to you now, but I'm struck by the fact that Falada, unlike those other writers I cited, he was a very weak man. He was maybe equally famous to them at the time, but he was a very weak man with drug and alcohol problems and other psychological distress, and yet he is the one who decided to stay and try to survive under the Reich.
But then he wound up being sentenced to an asylum.
He did. He suffered many indignities. He was put onto the various blacklists that the Nazis kept against artists. He went in and out of favor with them according to how he behaved. But he persevered somehow. In fact, we had a wonderful time. We brought over Hans Falada's son, Ulrich Ditzen, who was a teenager at the time of his father's death. So he had many vivid memories, and he told me, you know, we had no idea of what my father was going through because we had a beautiful home, and we had food when nobody we knew had food. And he really protected us and kept us sheltered from all this. All I knew was that occasionally he went on business trips to Berlin, and that was how the family mass is.
And what happened after the war ended? He set out to write this last novel, Every Man Dies Alone?
He did not last long. He had fallen apart during the war, which is why he was incarcerated. And when he got out, he was pretty much a wreck. He relaunched all his addictions. He had a morphine addiction, a cocaine addiction. He drank a lot. His wife eventually kicked him out, and he took up with another young woman and married her because she was essentially his drug connection. And he died in February of 1947. During that time, the year or two that after the war until his death, he wrote ferociously. He wrote three books on the whole. This was the last one.
And Primo Levi called it the greatest book ever written about German resistance to the Nazis. And yet it's not been translated until now. Mm. What happened? Why?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons for that. I think the fact that Falada stayed in Germany immediately cast him as a Nazi sympathizer post-war. I think as well that he, after the war ended, he ended up on the Russian side, the Soviet side of Germany, and that didn't, during the Cold War, that didn't help his reputation any either. But beyond that, I think it simply represents just a lack of editorial acumen in the West. The second I read a few pages of Hans Falada, I knew he must be in print, and I was going to do everything I could to get him back in print. But I think just the way that the American literary culture has gone in the last 10 or 20 years meant that, you know, after some of the political objections were moot, there was no taste for publishing a translated work by a German writer, a massive, long saga like that. It's expensive.
It's about a German couple, Otto and Anna Quangel, who decide to wage a campaign against the Nazis after their son dies fighting on the front lines. And they do it a rather postmodern way, with postcards.
Well, I think you know, it's no coincidence that Falada decided to tell the story of a couple that feels they are up against the most awesome power that ever was, and what in the world can they do? They decide to write something. I think this is a very telling metaphor for the situation he felt that he himself was in, and he was able to, as Alan Furst said, he was able to finally take his wax at his oppressors.
Although he based it on a real couple, Otto and Elise Hampel. And you include excerpts from the Gestapo files about the Hampels. Mm-hmm. How did you get your hands on those?
Well, everything that's left, for you know, the Nazis were the greatest documentarians of all time. All their records are still around and available in the German National Archives, and we simply, through a German version of the Freedom of Information Act, got them.
You have mentioned elsewhere that the bombing of Berlin and the division of post-war Germany made it difficult to track down publishing rights to these books and information about that would allow you to do this project.
No, it was a mess. It still is.
I would have just thought that they would have been in the public domain because of the circumstances of the war.
No, they'll be in the public domain in a little while. 70 years after an author's death is the German rule for copyright. But it was just a mess because he had a publisher that he stood by for years and years, even worked in their office called Rowald, one of Germany's major publishers. They were in the West. After the war, he found himself in the East. He took up with an East German publisher. Both of their buildings, headquarters, were bombed during the war, all contracts and records destroyed, and there was just a hellacious fight over his rights that went on for decades.
If you've published four of the books, I don't know how many books in all he wrote, but you've published four. I'm assuming they are the most accessible and the ones that you think are the best. If I wanted to start learning something about Hans Fallada, which one should I start with?
Every Man Dies Alone.
The last book.
Yeah, the last one. It's his work has amazing variety in it. The books are really very different one from the other. But what they have in common is a deep humanitarian streak, and yet at the same time they don't seem very sentimental or emotional. And this one really is kind of the capper to what he was doing. His books document his country, and they start with what happened after World War I and the food riots and the privations, and then right up to the Nazis. And so I think this one is really where he's saying everything he had to say about his place in the world as a writer.
What kind of response have you received? Have they been reviewed?
Oh, they've gotten sensational reviews. The New York Times called this the signal literary event of the year. It's certainly the biggest book in my company's history, and we even sublicensed our edition to Penguin in the UK, and both of us have over 100,000 copies in print. It's just sensational for us.
On the other hand, it's still an uphill battle, isn't it, to get any book in translation read these days?
I don't know about that anymore. I think people are getting a lot better about that. The problem is, of course, that translated books are simply more expensive to make, and that's why there are fewer of them made. You have to pay an author and a translator. So there are just fewer of them out there. There always have been. And now that the big publishers are kind of more driven by the bottom line and have different concerns and must have a hit every time out there, there are maybe less coming out from the big houses. But that leaves more opportunity for little publishers like Melville House, and we can see sometimes that really does work.
Are you on the lookout for other writers of this quality?
Oh, always, always. And you know, right now, because of the tremendous success of these books, I'm the king of Germany, so I'm getting an awful lot of books sent to me from Germany and from the Baltic states, from that time zone, so I'm ecstatic.
Well, one of the great surprises for me in doing this underappreciated series is how many really great writers have been largely overlooked, forgotten, gone into obscurity, even if they were once famous, like Christina Stead.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess somebody has to go out there and say, take another look at this. This is something that's quite extraordinary.
That's exactly right. It's a very crowded marketplace. You need a champion.
And for listeners who don't know how to spell Fallada, it's Falada. My great thanks to Dennis Johnson, the publisher of Melville House. Is it called Melville? Yeah, Melville House. And the publisher of these books for being on our show today.
Thanks so much, Leonard.